Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, how small, in terms of the number of molecules, is the smallest possible ice cube that can be made? No idea? Well, you can find out in a moment, because scientists have actually made one, and the answer may well surprise you. We'll also take a look at the building material that can sweat in warm weather to cut down aircon costs. And is this the stuff that Nobel Prizes are made of?
I describe myself as a reluctant scientist. I had absolutely no interest in research. I mean, I went to medical school for one reason and one reason only, and that was to become a practicing physician. And my first year at the NIH, I utterly and completely failed. Nothing I did worked. I hated it. And I decided that I wanted no part of research.
Thankfully, everything changed for Robert Lefkowitz, who joins us in a moment.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and with us for this, the November 2012 edition of Chemistry World, are Andrew Turley, Ian Le Guillou, and Neil Withers, who has been looking at the cold stuff.
Well, how many water molecules do you think it takes to make an ice cube?
It's obviously going to be a trick question. I know that you get these hydrates, these little tiny ice cubey things that are watery cages, and they are in the region of about 22. So I'd go for that sort of ballpark.
Okay, that's not a bad guess. But those aren't really proper ice, you know, with the sort of the hexagonal structure of hydrogen bonded water molecules that we all know and love and learn about and put in our gin and tonic. So it turns out that the smallest ice cube that is recognisably ice would have about 275 water molecules in.
That's quite a few. How do they know that, and why do you need 275?
How they found out, using mass spec, this was by Thomas Zeuch and Udo Buck, both from various institutions in Germany, they used mass spec and IR. So they used mass spec to look at very small clusters of water molecules, only from, say, 70, 80 molecules up to several hundred. So they used mass spec because then they could pick out the right sizes. And then they used IR to look at the structure of what was going on inside those clusters. So all the different bonds have a different characteristic frequency, and the solid ice has a very characteristic one, whereas the amorphous or liquid has a different one. And then when it got to 275, they saw the characteristic solid peak.
Why that threshold number, though? What is going on between 270 water molecules, let's say, and 275, that means it suddenly starts to form ice? It must come down to energetics or something.
It's energetics, and it's the size of the cluster that's the important thing. So as we all know from our gin and tonics and other soft drinks with ice cubes in, the ice floats because ice is less dense than liquid water because it takes more space to make this hydrogen-bonded network as a solid than as a liquid. So below a certain size, the clusters are too small for this hydrogen-bonded network to form. So it's impossible to get the ice that we know in these lower clusters, whereas by 275, in the very centre, you start to get some of this kind of crystalline ice.
What are the implications of us knowing this? I mean, it's a natty story, it's fun, but does it have implications for chemistry or understanding the world around us that you need 275 water molecules to make a miniature ice cube?
Well, as you say, water is all around us. In the atmosphere, there's an awful lot of different size water droplets forming clouds and things like that. So knowing exactly at what point it changes from a liquid to a solid and at what point the different phases are there could be very important for atmospheric chemistry.
Thank you very much. Neil, Andrew, sticking with the watery theme, what's this about using water to keep buildings cool? Normally, it's just the workers in the building who keep cool by giving them a drink.
Right, so we all cool ourselves down using water. We all sweat, and it's water on the surface of our skin that, as it evaporates, it helps to cool us down. Now, it turns out you can do something similar with buildings by controlling water on the surface of the buildings. And the reason you might want to do this is because keeping buildings cool is hugely energy intensive.
In hot countries where they're spending a lot of energy just running aircon units to keep the cold in and the hot out.
Absolutely. So if you can keep those energy costs down, it all helps towards our emissions targets and the bigger climate change picture.
But this could be about to change.
Perhaps. What Wendelin Stark and his colleagues at ETH Zurich in Switzerland have done is developed a kind of gel that'll hold water onto the surface of the building. And it will, in a cyclic nature, it'll hold water when it rains. It'll grab that water and keep it there. And then when it gets too hot, when the building gets too hot, it'll release that water and the building will almost sweat.
And in the process of doing that, you remove energy from the surface of the building in order to turn the water back into water vapour.
Yes, you use the energy to energise the water, and then as that is removed, the building stays cool. And they predict that you could save 60% of your emissions, CO2 emissions, through using this kind of eco-cooling.
The fly in the ointment, I could see, though, is that if you've got a well-insulated building, then you're going to have thermal changes on the outside surface. But how would you get that to go inside the building?
So this wouldn't necessarily be for everywhere. Really, this has been designed for tropical environments where there's a lot of water, it's raining very regularly, and then it gets very hot as well. And also these happen to be very poor regions, usually, where insulation is either you can't afford it or perhaps you don't need it because it doesn't get that cold.
Is it easy to retrofit? Is it literally a question of you slap this stuff on with a paintbrush? Or if cost is a problem, if it's really hard to build and apply this stuff, that could be an impediment.
The base units for it shouldn't really be that expensive. The thermoresponsive hydrogel is based on a fairly common polymer. What the researchers found is that they can hold 5 millimetres of water, and that's enough to cool a building on a sunny day using these polymers.
And just out of interest to hear you say a very long name, because I'm sure it's got one, what is the polymer?
The polymer is, wait for it, poly-N-isopropylacrylamide, which abbreviates very nicely to PNAPAM.
Sounds like it should be an appetising tropical cocktail. Thank you, Andrew. And now to somebody who describes himself as, initially at least, a reluctant scientist, but one who has subsequently gone on to radically change the world of biology and pharmacology with his discovery of the workings of G-proteins and G-protein-coupled receptors. These are the structures that enable hormones and nerve transmitters to pass signals between cells, and now he's been rewarded with the Chemistry Nobel Prize.
My name is Dr. Robert J. Lefkowitz. I'm a professor of medicine and biochemistry at Duke University Medical Center in Durham, North Carolina, in the USA. Receptors are molecules on the surface or within cells. The kind of receptors that I study are on the surface of cells with which drugs and hormones initially interact. Circulating in our blood are all manner of biologically active molecules. Some of these are hormones or neurotransmitters or substances that we make ourselves. Other times they are drugs, which are given to us by physicians. The question is, how do they exert their actions on the appropriate tissues, and how do they do the right thing? And so the job of the receptor is to discriminate these different types of molecules. We often use the analogy of a lock and a key. So the key would be a circulating molecule in the bloodstream. Let's take adrenaline as an example, which might be secreted into your bloodstream if you were experiencing the proverbial fight or flight response. Now, it's got to know to bind to your heart's cells, for example, to make them beat stronger and faster. How does it do that? Well, it finds a molecule on the surface of a heart cell called the beta adrenergic receptor, which is complementary to the structure of adrenaline. It is a lock into which the key adrenaline is able to fit. Now it's able to turn that lock and stimulate molecules inside the cell. They happen to be called G proteins, which lead to a whole cascade of events, which in this case makes the heart beat stronger and beat faster.
Before you came along and solved the structure of what they look like and how they work, What did scientists think was going on when you dropped some adrenaline onto a heart cell in a dish and it beat more quickly and more forcefully?
It was really a black box. And in fact, right up until the early to mid-1970s, there was a great deal of skepticism as to whether structures or molecules, which we today know as receptors, even existed at all. Many of the leading pharmacologists in the world were very, very skeptical.
So how did you then approach that and say, we have to work out how these cells are interpreting these signals?
It was clear that in order to do this, we would need to develop some new technologies that would allow us to study the receptors directly. Since the core function of a receptor was to bind or interact with a molecule like adrenaline or with a beta blocker if you had that drug, we thought that the most direct way in would be to make a radioactively labeled form of one of these drugs, and then see if we could work out the technology for actually sticking it to the putative or alleged receptors in the cell. If we could, it would give us a way of tracking the receptors and studying them directly. And we were successful in doing that in the early 70s. And then we were able to use these techniques as a way of always tagging or finding the receptors. And then over the next decade, we developed techniques for solubilizing the receptors, that is, removing them from the cell membrane with detergents, and then purifying them to what we call homogeneity, that is, isolating the receptor molecules. This was a very daunting task because there are very few of the receptors in the cell membrane. In fact, we had to purify the receptors 100,000-fold from solubilized cell membranes in order to obtain them in isolated form. Once we had them isolated, we could chop them up in a variety of ways and get little stretches of the sequence of the protein. And then we could use those stretches of amino acid sequence to design nucleotide probes, which allowed us to clone the gene for these several of these receptors and thereby learn the complete amino acid sequence. And when we did that, we had a true eureka moment. In the deduced sequence of the beta adrenergic receptor, which was the very first one that we were able to solve, we could see that it had very marked similarity to the structure of a molecule called rhodopsin, which is a molecule in the retinal membrane, which allows us to perceive light. And as soon as we saw that these two remarkably divergent molecules for sensing our environment, light in one case, adrenaline in the other, looked like each other, it immediately dawned on us that maybe all of this big family of receptors would look alike. And in fact, over the next several years, we were able to clone the genes for 10 of these different receptors. And true, they all were very close in their amino acid sequence. And so we knew that this was a general principle of biology, that all of these receptors were part of what we call the same gene family, and that they all worked in a similar way.
It's taken you about 40 years to produce the huge corpus of work that you have and win a Nobel Prize for it, justly. How long would it take you to do the same stuff today, armed with the molecular tools we now have? Would it be a summer's work or slightly longer?
Well, I think it would be slightly longer, but I dare say I myself marvel at the progression of techniques since when I was in the laboratory 40 years. I often point out to my trainees that with the exception of one or two techniques, such as some forms of chromatography, column chromatography, there's virtually no technique that we use routinely in my laboratory that had even been invented when I started in the laboratory a little bit more than 40 years ago.
I was talking with John Gurdon the other day, who is in a lab down the corridor from me, and he has on his desk his school report from his science teacher telling him he should forget it and go and do Greek instead, which is exactly what the school said he should do. Do you have any kind of letter of disparagement or rejection that you refer to remind you that you are human as well as being a Nobel laureate?
Well, I'll tell you this. I describe myself as a reluctant scientist. I had absolutely no interest in research. I mean, I went to medical school for one reason and one reason only, and that was to become a practicing physician. In fact, I had never really failed at anything until I got to the National Institutes of Health in 1968 as a clinical and research associate for a two-year, what was essentially a postdoctoral fellowship.
And my first year at the NIH, I utterly and completely failed. Nothing I did worked. I hated it. And I decided that I wanted no part of research. During the second year, things started to work a bit better, and I started to catch the bug. I still went ahead and finished the residency, but then I gravitated back into the research. But that first year of abject failure was certainly very chastening. Most of research is failure. It's that simple. I mean, 99% of everything you do is doomed to fail. And in fact, I actually give a tutorial to research fellows here at Duke every year called How to Deal with Failure and Rejection in Science. Yeah, I think there's some important lessons in that.
I think there's a lesson in that for all of us, isn't there? That was Chemistry Nobel laureate Robert Lefkowitz. Coming up shortly, a new breakthrough that means electronic circuit boards could repair themselves. Before that, though, medical implants and sensors that can dissolve inside the body. Ian.
So this is the latest development to come out from John Rogers from the University of Illinois, where we have an electronic circuit that will dissolve over time. Now, normally there'd be no reason that you'd want your circuit to dissolve, but in this case, we could have it using as an implant for medical purposes, say, that will last for a prescribed amount of time before eventually dissolving freely into the body. And so it allows you to implant a device without ever having to take it back out again and avoiding any long-term effects.
How did they do that?
They had previously developed a device that uses the silicon circuit on top of a silk layer. And the silk was able to dissolve quite happily. But now they found that if you make the silicon circuit thinner, so about 10 times thinner, down to only 20 nanometers thick, that it will slowly dissolve away at a rate of about 1 nanometer a day.
And is that sort of thickness actually still useful? Can you do stuff at that sort of resolution?
So they've been testing out a few different devices that you could attach to something like this. So they've already developed a 64-pixel camera that you'd be able to implant, as well as using things as an antenna or as a temperature sensor, even a solar cell. They've tried. I'm not sure why you'd want to implant that in someone, but...
a solar cell?
It's there to be tested.
Energy on tap. The idea being that you could do sort of invasive monitoring, which would then not require further invasive surgery to get it back out again.
Exactly. And you'd be able to alter the thickness of the silicon layer and make sure that it lasts for only a certain length of time.
Ingenious. Is it safe, though?
It certainly appears to be. They've tested it out on mice so far, and they can see that within the set amount of time, all of the device disappears, and the silicon and magnesium that make up the circuit are just absorbed by the body and can be easily excreted.
I suspect probably they come out in your wee, I would think, wouldn't they? Any suggestion they're moving this to the clinic now, or is this still very much planted in the basic medical sciences, not been translated camp?
It seems like it has every potential to go into clinical uses. I think it may be just a bit more work on making the devices that you can attach that bit more useful and making it worthwhile using these.
So if you had John Rogers sitting in front of you and he offered to make you some kind of sensor that you could implant, what would it be?
Well, that's a tricky one. unless I could have, like, wireless internet with me everywhere I went.
OK, I take it for wireless internet. What would you have, Neil?
Well, having had my health checkup recently, I'd like to monitor my cholesterol so I know if I can have an extra piece of cheese or not.
You better not make the sensor out of cholesterol then, because it'll certainly go up. Tell us about this wood story.
OK, so if you've dug up an ancient piece of wood from an archaeological dig or maybe from some geological strata, you want to know what that type of wood is, like whether it's oak or beech or laurel or whatever. And what Pierre Adam and colleagues have done is they found a molecule that is a molecular fossil, which means they can identify what type of wood it is.
Can we not tell different types of wood then? Can we not look under the microscope and say, oh, that structure is oak and that one's a beech?
You can for relatively young in an archaeological and geological sense, but once the wood is so old that it's been, say, it's been shipwrecked for thousands of years and it's gone blackened and aged and you can't see any of the structure, then you just can't tell by conventional means.
So what is their solution? What have they done?
So their solution is they've found a specific molecule that occurs only in oak, and they've sort of traced its evolution over time, and they found this molecule, this kind of fingerprinting triterpenoid, and they can specifically say that it doesn't occur anywhere else. So if you find this molecule in a piece of old wood, that it must have been oak.
Does this stuff accumulate over time, or is it there from the time at which the tree is growing? And
yes,
therefore, it doesn't matter how old the piece of wood is, you can still nonetheless say that is oak.
Yeah, so this molecule occurs naturally in wood, the original one, and over time it changes from its original form, which has two oxygenated groups next to each other. And then over time, they think by some sort of bacterial effect, it becomes slightly different, and there's only one oxygenated part, and it's in the specific place where it doesn't occur in the natural oak. So they know that it's not come from a new piece of oak, you know, next door or being contaminated. So they know that it really is old oak.
Can you therefore work out how old by titrating the amount, or do we not know at what rates it accumulates, and so that wouldn't be possible?
I don't think they can work that out. I guess they'd use carbon dating for that, but this is instead of to age it, it's just to identify it.
Is there not a danger that there might be a relatively recent piece of wood that doesn't have any of this stuff in because it hasn't been in the ground long enough, so you would mistake it for something else? Or is it pretty clear cut?
I think it's quite clear cut. There's a very distinct difference between the molecule that occurs in current oak and between the kind of the marker, the old marker, and you wouldn't get any overlap between the two. You would either have the new molecule that occurs in fresh oak, if you like, or you would have the very much older one. So you'd be able to tell that it was old.
And just oak, or...?
At the moment, it is just oak, but they hope to find other versions of this molecule that might occur in other types of wood. So they'll have, like, an archaeological toolkit, a molecular fossil toolkit, so they can go and analyse different pieces of wood and say, OK, so it's got this compound, it must be ash, or it must be birch.
That would be nice. Thanks, Neil. Now, if, like me, you've been a victim of other people's poor parking abilities and you've come back to your car to find that it's been scratched or dented, then you'll relish the work of this man, who's working on ways to equip surfaces, including car bodywork, with the ability to repair themselves. He's doing it by embedding or even circulating healing chemicals through the materials in much the same way that our own vascular system delivers clotting factors to a wound.
My name is Scott White. I'm a professor at the University of Illinois. I work at the Beckman Institute, and I lead the research group that is called the Autonomous Material Systems Group. And basically, we are trying to create materials that have the same kind of function that biological materials have, or biological systems. We create materials that do things like they heal themselves whenever they're damaged.
So what sorts of applications are right at the forefront that you could say this is a real priority, that we solve this?
Here in the next maybe year or so, you'll start to see self-healing coatings being offered in the commercial market, put on to materials to protect them from corrosion.
So this would be, for instance, on my car. So as I'm driving along and I accidentally scratch it on the side of the garage or something as I'm maneuvering out, that scrape could put itself right so I don't then end up with the bare metal going rusty.
Precisely.
But the one problem with this is, yes, it works on the first occasion. What about if I do it again?
Right. So what's the likelihood that you're actually going to scratch it in the exact same place a second time? It's pretty low to begin with. So even if you have a one-shot healing system, it's going to end up extending the lifetime of these kinds of products. The second aspect is that original technology, which is based on microcapsules that are releasing a healing agent in the material, and it gives you an ability to heal one time locally, wherever that capsule actually was living in the material. And we asked the question, well, if all the capsules are broken, you've released the entire supply of healing agent for that material, you can't heal anymore. So what's beyond that concept in terms of healing that would allow us to do this repeatedly. And so that sparked a new line of research on microvascular material systems. And now instead of dispersing capsules that contain the healing agents throughout these materials, we actually deploy a vascular network now of interconnected microchannels so that we can circulate healing agents throughout the entire volume of that material and continue to replenish the supply of healing agents.
What are the chemicals that you're using that are capable of doing these interesting reactions? And how do you make sure that it only goes off where it needs to?
The way we approach this is to have isolated vascular networks. So it's not just one network that we're working with, but at least two. And then we isolate the components of that chemistry from each other by putting them into separate networks. So when they are damaged, you know, you penetrate both of these networks equally. The release of fluids from both of those networks then goes to the site of damage, it mixes locally, and you get a chemical reaction.
How easy would it be to have a car that had a vascular system under its paintwork so that the odd scratch and dent could repair itself? I would think this is going to be pretty difficult, isn't it, to plumb this in?
What we've done is to look at that problem in terms of its manufacturing and make it scalable and cost-effective. The way we do that is to create a material that we can remove after all the normal types of processing has occurred to reveal the vascular network that we intended in the first place. And the way we do that is we create fibers or particles or sheets of material out of a very special polymer treated such that it will depolymerize and volatilize into a gas and remove itself from the host material system. It reveals the vascular architecture now. The fibers that we make in order to make these channels are structurally robust. You can, you know, tug on them, you can weave them, you can integrate them in very typical materials that are used in industrial processes. And they survived that in the first place. So it's an easy add-in to existing manufacturing techniques.
Can you tell me then where you think this really is going to really bring home some money? And where is this really going to make a difference to the world around us?
For anything from cosmetic damage to your cell phone or your consumer electronic products, beyond cosmetics. One of the newest target areas that we've been working in lately has been in self-healing electronics, basically reestablishing the ability to conduct electrons, which is what, you know, a microelectronic circuit is really trying to do. So we've been encapsulating conductive particles, like nanotubes, liquid metals, basically a whole range of things that have this ability to reestablish conductivity, and integrating those into microelectronic packaging.
So people often say that they end up with problems with a PCB, a printed circuit board, in a computer that's been flexed by temperature or something, and it breaks some of the tracks, and then the computer fails. So this will be very important in installations that are hard to service or are remote or in space or something, and therefore if you had electronics that could repair itself, it would be much safer, but also a lot cheaper and more convenient.
Exactly. It'll probably be first rolled out in applications where it's simply impossible to repair it or swap it out and replace it. If you send something up into space, you're not going to be able to go back up there and do anything about it. So you want a self-healing circuit that will allow you to accomplish the intended mission. More terrestrially, let's say, if your computer or let's say your cell phone suffer mechanical flexure, you know, when you press on them, but they also do thermal cycling, and you flex that substrate and it undergoes fatigue. And eventually that leads to some mechanical damage that interrupts circuit lines. And that's exactly the kind of damage that this type of healing approach can fix now. So maybe we won't be replacing our computers and cell phones every year or two.
Much to the manufacturer's chagrin, I'm sure. That was Scott White. He's at the University of Illinois. Nanotubes now. Ian.
So these are self-assembling nanotubes that respond to temperature. Now, these kind of self-assembling nanotubes aren't anything all that new, really. You just have a single molecule. In this case, it's kind of a boomerang shape. And you get six of these coming together to form a hexagon. And these hexagons then stack on top of each other until you get to maybe 1,000 high. And what you then have is a tube that's constructed. Now, we see these quite a lot in nature, in maybe like the tobacco mosaic virus, which constructs itself from a protein that will build itself up in a similar kind of way. What's unique about these new nanotubes that Myung-Soo Lee from Seoul University has done is that they, when you heat up the tubes, they begin to close in on themselves and start to constrict the central hole.
So if the central hole constricts, does that mean that you could load the tube with some kind of cargo and that it would effectively squirt out like toothpaste?
That's exactly what they did. They were able to fill up these tubes with using buckyballs.
It's good if you've got nano-sized teeth, isn't it? You could sort of clean them up. No, what do they actually see these as being used for? Why would you want to do that? How could it have a role?
So with the buckyballs, for example, when the tube closes up, it then arranges all of these buckyballs in a line very close to each other. Now, if you were able to use these with, say, conducting nanoparticles, you would then be allowed to conduct an electric current along this wire. And then once you cooled it down, the tube would expand and the nanoparticles would separate from one another and you'd break the circuit.
So the effect is reversible?
Yes, absolutely. So you can heat it up and it's only up to about 50 degrees centigrade and it'll start to close. It's a perfectly reasonable temperature, and you cool it back down to room temperature and it'll expand again.
How easy are these things to make? Could we actually see this being scaled?
Absolutely. I mean, you just need to synthesize this one small molecule and it will build itself up into these larger structures.
So are there any applications already in the offing for this? It sounds like there should be.
Well, this is still very new research. It's still going to take a while to build it up to an industrial scale, but it's all building part of the puzzle for a larger industry in these kind of nanomaterials, nanotechnology, where you can build these kind of circuits and systems using molecules like these.
Something much bigger are flares. You presumably, though, Andrew, don't mean a fairly tragic 1970s fashion.
Absolutely not. This is all about decoys for fighter jet planes and that sort of thing, familiar from such films as Top Gun. It turns out that there's a bit of an arms race between the decoys and the missiles. If you make the missiles better, then you need to make the decoys better to send them off the other way.
This is the stuff that aeroplanes chuck out of the back when they're being pursued by some kind of heat-seeking missile or something in order to put it off the scent.
Yes. These decoys, you send them out if you know there's a missile tracking you. And historically, the missiles have actually, they tracked heat. And so you're able to send them off with quite a simple pyrotechnic flare of some kind. But that's not good enough for more modern missiles, which are much more sophisticated and can track the characteristic carbon dioxide and water vapor traces left by an aircraft. So if you want to send these off, you have to use more sophisticated flares. Now, the problem with that is the materials you use in those flares are very sensitive to impact, and you don't want something rattling around in your back of your plane that has the potential to blow a hole in your plane.
No, indeed. So what can we do instead?
So Ernst Christian Koch and friends at NATO in their centre in Brussels, Belgium, have been investigating the use of TNT, which is 2,4,6 trinitrotoluene, the very famous explosive. And historically, this is a material that hasn't really been investigated as a pyrotechnic material. It's been investigated as an energetic material for blowing holes in mines and that sort of thing, but fallen from favour more recently.
For what reason? Just because it's been superseded by more powerful agents?
I think more powerful, but also easier to use. So TNT, you need to mix with something else if you want it to explode. So famously, you can just set light to a bit of TNT and it'll burn away quite merrily.
But it won't blow up?
It won't blow up without something else mixed in with it.
So what do the Brussels NATO team say? What is their finding?
So they found that it could potentially be very useful as a decoy material once it is activated with oxidizing agents, because it is, although it once mixed with an oxidizer, it is sensitive to impact and friction. It's less shock sensitive than the current alternatives. And it also gives off something of this carbon dioxide trace that is characteristic of emissions from a plane.
Which would mean that it would actually make quite a good chemical material for that reason as well.
Absolutely.
Stick with the pyrotechnic theme, though. What have you got up your sleeve for our trivia?
Well, very apt for this time of year, we've got something about fireworks. And it turns out that until the middle of the 19th century, fireworks were really quite boring affairs.
I've been to a few displays in the 20th and 21st century that have been quite boring. But
that's just because you're old, Chris. The kids still find them fun.
What was wrong with the ones in the 18th and 19th centuries then?
They, despite what we knew about flame tests and such like, they didn't contain the chemicals that created the colours. Really, they were just the regular flame-coloured explosions.
So just sort of whitey-yellow. There were none of these bright greens and reds and everything.
No, back then people were satisfied with the whiz and the bang and just boring old yellowy-white explosions.
Wow. Why did people not say, well, let's have some colours? I mean, people, I cannot believe that, you know, you've got Robert Bunsen publishing a treatise in the mid-1800s on spectroscopy, and he knew all about this sort of thing. So other people must have done too. Why was no one putting a little bit of copper in, making a green colour? Just didn't occur to people?
I would imagine it relates to volumes in which these sorts of materials are produced. The coloured compounds are probably not going to be involved in more trivial things until large-scale industrial processes are producing them as byproducts.
And your favourite firework today of the modern era is...
Oh, I like the ones that just explode really, really big. The biggest one right at the end.
And that's the climax of this programme too. That's it for this month. Thank you to the Chemistry World team, Andrew Turley, Ian Legiu and Neil Withers, and also our guests, Robert Lefkowitz and Scott White. The production was by Meera Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Please do join us next month for more news from the world of chemistry. But for now, though, thanks for listening and goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.